to come back and, you know, he'd say, I don't want security. I don't want you. I don't want you, you know, following me to work from my house. But they did anyway, and I know one occasion he stopped the car and went back to their security car, told them to disappear. He didn't want them.
And did that?
No. But kept a very discreet distance, but, you know, really quite awkward for them. And when he became Prime Minister, we thought that, well, I was already gone by then, but I know the boys thought that they might have a few problems with him. But in fact, it ended up just the reverse. He was he got very, very close to his his team. My successor had an enormously good rapport with Keating, and that seems to have been the way. That the success of the thing is. Was the rapport between the Prime Minister and, in Fraser's case, it was the head of his team, George Davidson. In Whitlam's case, it was the whole team he got on well with, but particularly the boss of his team, which is a fellow called Barry Brown, who ended up working with Kerr, funny enough, as well, when Kerr was Governor General, which was an interesting shift, but didn't worry Whitlam in the slightest. I mean, he was a great Barry Brown fan. You know, I had this amazing rapport with Hawke and the family, as did most of my people, and I know how it's been the same. And so, you know, there certainly is a pattern there that once they get into the position of Prime Minister, they do understand that that's a necessary evil. They all treat it in different ways. Their personalities are all different. The way they approach it is usually different, which means that the team has to be flexible about how they deal with the Prime Minister.
Would seem from an outside perspective, it might be an advantage in the fact that the security teams are all very small, certainly in the years that you were working with.
Yes, that's right.
And that therefore there was much more ability to perhaps get to know.
Yes, that's right. That's right, and that's the difference between the way we operate and the Secret Service operate. I mean, the Secret Service would have certainly they'd have one overall boss who's very, very senior, probably in our terms a deputy commissioner level, who's the head of the presidential security. But then his team leaders would all be fairly senior people, and he would see a lot of those, and they would have a personal rapport with the president. But the other 100 work with him every day, you know. And they just do 8-hour shifts, and they just stand in corridors, and terribly boring. You know, I much rather, you know, I had a far more interesting, career in VIP protection than most Secret Service agents would working with the President of the United States.
Did I understand you correctly at one point that you actually... you mentioned Doug Anthony and his acting prime ministership at the coast. Were you involved?
Well, only on one occasion. I think it was over Christmas, and so it would be Christmas 1978, I guess. I think the prime minister stood down, you know, for a couple of weeks and I'm gone on holiday. But because it was holiday time, Anthony had a holiday home on New Brighton Beach, up near Mullumbimby, up near Byron Bay, beautiful spot. And he used to run the country from a caravan parked outside his house. So as acting Prime Minister, he had a team of police who used to go up there. And they used to operate out of the caravan. He didn't. They used to operate out of the caravan. And then we used to get local police to look after the place 24 hours a day. And the team, in fact, would stay at a nearby motel, which is literally only just down the road. That was all pretty pleasant. I mean, you know, you dress for the occasion, so you're looking after the Prime Minister in your thongs and shorts and T-shirt on the beach.
So that bulge in your shorts was...
fortunately, in those days, you know, bum bags were the thing, so... You know, that's where you kept your stuff. Yeah.
Any of the parliamentary staff that you came in dealing with during your time here that stood out, that sort of a can remember special things about?
Well, the staffers themselves.
Staffers.
Yeah, staffers. Graham Freudenberg, you know, is a character who immediately comes to mind as probably the Labour Party's most famous speechwriter, without a doubt the Labour Party's most famous speechwriter for New South Wales premiers and prime ministers, and wrote many, many major speeches, but was quite eccentric, Graham. Lovely man, but quite eccentric. I recall one occasion when we were in the States. Graham used to write all his speeches in the middle of the night, assisted by normally a few cans of Foster's and copious amounts of cigarettes. And he had a secretary who I don't think she ever got to finish a drink or finish a meal with him, because he would go to dinner and want to write a speech, and she'd go down with him and never have a chance to eat, but just be taking notes all the time. But also in the middle of the night, he would have his inspiration in the middle of the night. And I can remember one night, and I think we were in the Madison Hotel in Washington, when I had a knock on the door at 2 o'clock in the morning. I was asleep. It was a Secret Service agent, terribly apologetic, and saying, could I step out into the corridor and tell him if this member of our staff was all right? And I went out, and there was Graham in the corridor with his hotel dressing gown flapping in the breeze and a pair of undies on, with a can of Foster's in each hand, also a lit cigarette in each hand, because he was a chain smoker, wandering up and down the corridor talking to himself. And Secret Service thought this was quite strange, but until I explained to them that all Australian speechwriters operated in that way, and everything was okay. But that was fairly typical of Graham. And then the next day he used to come out with the most magnificent speech for the Prime Minister. It was quite amazing. Yeah, great, great character. And I must say that I've met some of Hawke's personal staff, most of them, his personal staff and his public service staff, were just very, very good people. One of his, he had several, of course, chiefs of staff during his period as Prime Minister. One of them, Sandy Holway, who subsequently became involved in the Olympics, but was a senior public servant. Sandy would probably be the best manager of people I have ever come across. There could be all sorts of political things happening in the office that he would have to deal with, and if somebody on the staff had a personal problem, I mean, Sandy would just deal with it amongst everything else that he was doing. He was a very, very clever, subsequently became, you know, had a major role in organising the Olympic Games, and now I think he's our ambassador for Wales or something, isn't he? WHALES. No. he's got some government function now, but you know, he was. Dennis Richardson was another one. Dennis Richardson was another chief of staff who subsequently became head of immigration and then director general of ASIO and our ambassador, and he's just been appointed, of course, head of foreign affairs. People, you know, just really, really class people. I mean, Hawke used to seem to attract the best, and they all loved working for him. And they were just really good people, because we used to all travel together. So, as I said once before, it was a team thing. It didn't matter what role you played, you were part of an overall team. Some of the ministers, you know, John Button, who died last year, was his industry minister, was a great character. Mick Young, who also died very early, one of the real time shearers and, you know, union people, but just a really genuine person. Kim Beazley, Rhodes Scholar, very, very clever man. I know the Americans thought that when he was the defence minister, he was the best defence minister in the world. One they had most respect for was Kim Beazley.
Yeah, we're talking junior, not senior here.
Yeah. Gareth Evans was, you know, just incredibly bright, pretty difficult man to get on with at times, but get pretty short fuse, Gareth, but you know, amazingly clever. Yeah. So he had a really good team there. And some interesting people like Graham Richardson and Robert Ryan and a few others. I just felt that as a policeman, as a career policeman, it was an enormously privileged position to be in, you know, to be exposed to not only those people, but to all sorts of people at all sorts of functions you went to all sorts of business leaders, who many of whom were Hawke's friends, people like Frank Lowy, who was a great personal friend, and if when Hawke really needed a break and get away from it all, and there were times when he did, even if it was only for 3 or 4 days, often we used to, Frank Lowy used to make his beautiful cruiser available, and Frank Lowy would treat me no differently than he treated the Prime Minister in terms of as a host. Just amazing. I mean, just this, and that was, I think it was typical of Hawke and the people that he surrounded himself with, you know, that if you work for Hawke, he expected you to be treated in the same way as he was, but he had friends that did that anyway, so you weren't left, you know, sort of like a shag on a rock. You know, if you were with Hawke, you were part of the team, and that was it. So yeah, he's had some interesting press secretaries. Well, press secretaries, Barry Cassidy, of course, who's, you know, runs the Insiders program on the ABC now. We had a really, as I say, Hawke was a, loved his horse racing. That's one of his great relaxations. Barry's first trip as press secretary was on a Friday night, going over to Perth. We were travelling over to Perth in the evening. We got there quite late. But Hawke's Friday nights were usually with the racing guide, organising what he was going to put his money on for the next day. And it was sort of a sacrosanct time for him. So we were flying over on the VIP plane, so we had plenty of time to work out, you know, the horses for the next day. And he was a really good judge of good horse flesh. He knew everything about the racing game. So he'd marked up, you know, the racing guide and had all his other newspapers there. And his normal thing was, when he would get up the plane, he'd gather all the papers and give them to his press secretary to carry off the plane and look after him. And this was Cassidy's first trip as press secretary. So that happened, you know, we arrived in Perth, landed, Hawke gathered up his papers, gave him the Barry. Went on into the hotel and was going out that night. So I went to the hotel, had a shower, and called me. I was in the room next door, and called me, it might have been, you know, 10:30 at night. He said, "Oh mate, do you know where my racing guide is?" So I said, "No, I haven't seen it." He said, "Oh, well, you know, can you go and find Barry Cassidy? I gave him all the papers. He'll have it somewhere. He probably didn't know he had to bring them up to my room." So I said, "I'll go and find him." I found Cassidy in the bar having a drink with some of the journalists. And I said, "Butch, where's the boss wants his racing guide?" He said, "What do you mean his racing guide?" I said, "You know, his racing guide that he was working on." I said, "He gave it to you with all the papers." He said, "I put those in the rubbish bin. I thought he wanted them chucked out." So I said, this was at the airport. So I said, "Well, he's not going to be very happy." He said, "Oh, mate, this is my first trip. It could be my last one. Can you go and tell him?" So I said, "Yeah, I can tell him. He's not going to be very pleased." Anyway, I told him, and he just exploded. He couldn't believe it. He just exploded. The hotel manager came running up and offered to, they couldn't get these racing guides in He couldn't even get a new one in Perth. They didn't have them there. The hotel manager said he'd fly one over during the night from. Anyway, we got through that, and Cassidy got through his. And he still owes me a beer that he's never bought me, and I remind him every time I see him for saving his job on that occasion. But he was another interesting staffer and a real professional.
What about members of the press? Did you have any dealings, contacts?
Very much so. Because we used to, particularly here, because I think I've said earlier that we used to meet them every morning on the way in up the front steps of the Parliament House. But also, we used to travel with them. They used to travel on the same plane. When the VIP plane was a 707, the whole back section was reserved for the press to travel with the Prime Minister. That doesn't happen now because the plane's not big enough. I don't think they can get all the press on the plane. So I think they have to travel separately quite often. But certainly then all the the more important trips, you used to get all the senior members of the press gallery travel. So, you know, the Michelle Grattans and Laurie Oakes and Peter Harveys and of the world, you know, all the doyens of the press gallery used to travel. I used to get to know them very well. And I had a really good rapport with them. And they were very professional. They would know. I can't ever remember occasion when a journalist from the press gallery tried to get information from me. Never remember one occasion when that happened. If something happened that had something to do with security, which rarely did, they would ask me about it. And I'd tell them what I could tell them. But they knew I would know, I would be privy to conversations, and all that sort of stuff in cars and in rooms and that, but never once did anybody try and get information from me that I shouldn't have given, what I'm entitled to give out. We had a very, very good working relationship, and I used to look after them as well when we were overseas to make sure that they could get the shots that they wanted to get. I can remember a trip to Beijing in the mid-80s that Barry Cassidy was then on the trip, but as a journalist with the ABC, and he wanted to do a promo in Tiananmen Square. And the security forces wouldn't let him do it. It's like, wouldn't let a television camera do it. But we managed to intervene, and I, you know, explained to the security people that he was with the Australian Prime Minister and all the rest, and he got his stuff done. So it worked two ways. You know, they used to help us out, and we used to help them out when we could. So I still run into the journalists from time to time, in fact, when I retired from the police in 1998, and there was an election, I think late in 1998, when Laurie Oakes, who lives fairly close to where I do, so I run into him quite often, and knew that I had left the police and suggested to a current affair that it might be good to get me to do a current affairs show during the 1998 campaign, just to make general comments about security and that sort of thing without giving the secrets away. So I did, and I did it with one of the journalists, and went out for 2 days and did a day with Howard and a day with Beasley. Did a day with Beasley in Brisbane and a day with Howard in Melbourne, and demonstrations and all that sort of stuff. So that was pretty interesting. That had come about as a result of, you know, my friendship with Laurie. So, yeah, so it was a good relationship, and still is. I mean, because I'm still around Canberra and live nearby, I run into these fellows quite often. So.
So in 1990, did you resign from the job?
Well, I didn't. I decided to call it a day. I just went to the Prime Minister and said, look, you know, I think it's time, you know, I'd got remarried then, I had a, you know, two very young stepdaughters, and I just, the Prime Minister, I said, look, man, look, you know, I mean, people at staff, I mean, staff change over anyway. I mean, not many, too many people last 7 years like I did in the Prime Minister's office. They move on. So I just went to the Hawks and said, look, you know, I think it's time for me to move on. And he said, that's fine if that's what you want to do. Who's going to take your place? And I knew it would be between one of the three sergeants, senior sergeants I had working for me. And he said, who do you think? He said, who do you think should have it? And I told him, and he agreed with me. But in fact, the police had to advertise it. But the person he wanted and the person I suggested would be the best one, in fact, then became my successor, and then took over with Keating as head of Keating's thing, and built up this fabulous rapport with Keating, which probably I wouldn't have been able to do. Not necessarily. I mean, you know, having had the close relationship with Hawke that I had, you know, the fellow that took over from me was much better read than I was, and Keating was quite intellectual in that way. And, you know, they got on like a house on fire. So it's really is horses for courses. I'm not sure that I would have, you know, I certainly wouldn't have got on with Malcolm Fraser the way that George Davidson had done. So, you know, you just, it's whoever the right person at the right time is, and we happen to have been lucky to have the right person there all the time. Although, if it's going to be the wrong person, I mean, the Prime Minister would only have to say, look, I'm...
So you went on to become director of VIP protection in the AF.
Yeah, that's.
And that, I noticed that the Vincent, that includes personal protection for Australian holders of high office.
Yes.
Not the Prime Minister, obviously.
No, he had his own team, yeah. And then we're talking about other holders of high office, which means anybody that needed protecting for some particular reason. Nobody got it. Nobody else got it, apart from the Governor General. Nobody else got it as a matter of course, but they did from time to time. And I remember, you know, I remember Gareth Evans going to South Africa where he was going to meet some problems. I know we sent people over with him to South Africa, or and it included the diplomats that we look after.
Diplomats from that stationed here in
the UK. So the Israeli ambassador, and depending on the times, would be whether, and in those days the Turkish ambassador as well, always got full time protection.
There was also a man booth outside the South African embassy for many, many years.
Yeah, still there, the booth.
Was that run by that service?
Sorry?
Serviced or occupied by people from that VIP protection service?
No, that was the uniform branch that, you know, but now would be on the lodge, the Australian Protective Service, that are at the gate of the lodge. And those, you know, the threats against those, I mean, that was South Africans, was during the apartheid era, of course. The Turkish, there's the threat against the Turks now. It's what it used to be, so they don't get protection full time. So I think this is the only Israeli, I mean, and the British High Commissioner or the US Ambassador get it from time to time if there's a particular threat, and there is from time to time, particularly, you know, with the Middle East and Iraq and Afghanistan. So if there's a particular threat, teams would move on to those.
So the service provided by the VIP protection unit would have been as and when required.
Yes, apart from the permanent. Well, in those days it was the Turks and the Israelis, and then anybody else, and then the visiting heads of government, heads of state, that come under are internationally protected persons, which is a legal term under all the UN conventions as to who. So visiting heads of government, visiting heads of state get protection whilst they're in the country. So you would have a team doing those sorts of, and then supplementing other areas from time to time. And then everybody during election campaigns were on the road and used to bring other people in from interstate to help you out.
Noticed in your later career, you had you were actually in charge of security at the Constitutional Convention here in 1998.
That's right. That was part of my last role in the AFP. When I finished with VIP protection altogether, I became the Director of Security Intelligence and Diplomatic Liaison, which was a great title. In the old days, they used to call it Special Branch. In Britain, they still call it Special Branch. But Special Branch got some unfortunate connotations here in Australia with a few inquiries. So we called it Security Intelligence, which is what it was, and Diplomatic Liaison. And Diplomatic Liaison particularly applied here in Canberra. Of course, with any incident that involved a diplomat that involved policing. Could be uniform policing, could be speeding, could be a break-in, could be anything. Had to come through my branch for us to deal with, and we were the liaison then between diplomatic missions and the Department of Foreign Affairs Protocol Department, and worked very closely with them. And the security intelligence was a normal intelligence gathering, political intelligence gathering type operation, on minority groups and whatever you have, any risk, and that used to be done closely in liaison with the other security services, ASIO and what have you. So
was it in that capacity that the role of providing protection here in this building in 1998 came up as well?
No. My role there was, because I was head of security intelligence, was that I headed this. Really, I became part of the team that was organising the convention, advising on security issues. With the event organisers, which was a civilian organiser, and the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet that was fun. So I was sort of the security expert that was attached to the whole thing, and then I was responsible for monitoring any demonstrations that took place, and the liaison between the uniformed police and the ACT, and the Constitutional Convention in terms of having enough uniformed police to manage demonstrations and. Sort of stuff.
What special issues do you think protecting this building and in fact an event like that had? I mean, it was rather different to the role you had when you were here as Prime Minister's protection.
Again, it was all about planning. Yeah, like Prime Minister, it's all about planning and liaison it is about planning. That if anything happens, then you know, and you've got fallback plans, you've got contingencies to do. And it was about making sure that everybody knew what the threat was, who needed to know what the likely threats was from demonstrators. Consensual Constitutional Convention was probably the last big operational matter I dealt with in my career, which was really was nice for me to finish up my whole time in Canberra from 1978 to 1998, with starting at Parliament House with Malcolm Fraser and finishing up at Parliament House with the Constitutional Convention, because I retired shortly, within a few months of that.
Did actual event have any special? Were there any special happenings then?
I mean, nothing that wasn't controlled. We had the Aboriginal Embassy, of course, opposite, which gave obviously a great platform for demonstrations. And also, I mean, the whole thing was about, was Australia going to become a republic? So the various arms of Republican or anti-Republican movement had an opportunity to demonstrate, but nothing really got out of hand. There was one nasty demonstration, I think, involving the Aboriginal Embassy at one stage, one evening. And I think that happened, not sure that happened during the thing, it could have happened before or just after. But, you know, it was something we knew was going to happen and could, turn nasty and just a case of having enough people there to cope with it, to train for it. During my watch in that job, we had the loggers blockade of the new Parliament House, and also the demonstration that broke down the doors of the new Parliament House. So I was there for both of those. I think everybody was pleased when I retired. I think trouble used to follow me around.
We did have, of course, episodes even in this building back in your working here when the doors, front doors, were broken down.
Yes.
In this building.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know where we were then. We must have been interstate or somewhere. I don't think the Prime Minister was here then, was he? Was he? Yeah. I'm getting older. All of these things are all, you know, there have been so many of them, they all sort of tend to roll themselves. I have to do some research to find out what years I was doing what.
Well, perhaps we move on to some bits and pieces, I can call it that.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of your work here, did you actually have any social contact with anyone in the building here? While you were working during your period as in charge of the PM's security?
I certainly no social contact while I was on duty. Of course. Social contact? Yes. I guess so. It wasn't. Because you put in so many hours, you're pretty pleased to go home, I must say, at the end of the day, rather than socialise too much. But there were events. There were events organised, social events from time to time, with the Prime Minister's office that everybody went to. But as I say, you know, the hours were long for everybody, so... people were probably only too pleased to get home to their families, to be quite honest with you.
You've already mentioned that the work life had a very heavy impact on your family life.
Yes.
You mentioned hours. Can you give an idea of the sort of maybe how many hours a week you might put in regularly?
If Parliament was sitting, not that many. We used to work in two shifts, so you'd have a day shift and an afternoon shift. So and those hours were fairly regular. It was when you were on the road that the extreme was an election campaign, and that's the extremes of everything you did. But everything happened during an election campaign. But during an election campaign, you could be on the road for 4 or 5 weeks, depending on how long the campaign was. And it would be 18 hours a day.
And you would go with 4 or 5 weeks. You would be the person traveling with the.
I used to travel, and then the others used to pick up if I could get. If we were happy, because you were never back in Canberra, you see, very rarely. The only time you knew you were going to be back in Canberra was for the National Press Club address. When you might get 1 or 2 nights in Canberra in the 5 weeks, so you just might get home then to see the family, but probably it was at 10 o'clock at night and you left at 6 o'clock the next morning anyway. Often you would do 3 states in one day, so you'd start in Melbourne, do a function, go to Sydney, do one at lunchtime, end up in Brisbane that night, and then you do the rural areas, of course, as well. Where you went was where the marginal seats were, of course. And it's very an efficient way to work, of course, because there were so few of you and so much to do that you were on the go, you're all on the go or in the air, travelling all the time. Because my advanced teams, I used to have to get to all these places by civil aircraft. They weren't travelling in a VIP aircraft like I was. With the Prime Minister, so I'd want 2 people on the ground in Melbourne in the morning to work with me, and I'd want another 2 in Sydney for the afternoon function, another 2 in Brisbane. by the time we had left Melbourne, the two in Melbourne would then fly to wherever we were going the next day to do the advance for that. And particularly nowadays, the election campaigns are held very tightly. And you know, functions, a new function can come in at a day's notice or less than a day's notice. So, you know, and the blokes used to work, the fellows used to work with the staff, because the staff would do the same. There would be stenos and office people, so they used to team up with the police advance team, and they used to do travel as a team in the main to each place, although they had different roles. So they used to work very well, but as I say, huge hours. I mean, many a time, you know, 3 weeks into a campaign, you'd wake up in the morning in a motel room or hotel room somewhere and have absolutely no idea where you were until you opened the window or looked at your program and said, oh, look, I'm in Brisbane.
And there were still only seven of you.
Yeah.
And you were mentioning two here, two there.
Yep.
So that leaves you with one in reserve somewhere.
Well, that was me. The one in reserve was me on the plane. So I would be travelling anywhere. And my role was not just to travel with the Prime Minister, but it was also to liaise with the staff on the plane, because that's when a lot of the arrangements would be made. And the fellows, and then there would be